very much. I think it's about time to start. So as you can kind of see, this is the title of our event today. South itineraries, alternative routes of virtual learning between Latin America and Southeast Asia. So we do have the pleasure of having four speakers who are going to contribute to this event. The event itself is the first event the Southeast Asia Center, LSE, is organizing. For our Oikari Research Network members, but also B, widely for everyone at the LSE and beyond, to think about this very important issue. And the event is also organized as part of Decolonizing LSE Week. So we are very happy to make the contribution. The center is very happy to make the contribution. And very glad that our four esteemed speakers are joining us for sharing their thoughts. If I may just kind of briefly introduce the background of the event and also who I am, by the way. So I am Ken Bang Shin, Professor of Geography and Urban Studies in the Department of Geography and Environment, and also Center Director at Southeast Asia Center. If you are here for the first time and doesn't know about the center itself, what I'm asking is for you to visit this website, www.lse.sc/SEAC, which will have many events. Some of you may be interested in coming to those events. There are about 20 plus confirmed events for the rest of this year, so please do pay a visit to find out and join us in future events. So as far as today's event is concerned, this Decolonizing LSE event, it's really asking us to think about the way the knowledge gets produced. Recent development in critical scholarship is basically asking us to rethink how the knowledge gets dominated, especially the process of knowledge production that used to be dominated, is in need of expanding horizon and trying to basically find another way of other ways, alternative ways of knowledge production that goes beyond the existing regime and hegemony of the West. So the panel discussion is going to be very much an interdisciplinary conversation on the potential of building these itineraries of collaborative thinking between southern countries, going beyond the constraints incurred by the Western mediation. So the panel that we have is really going to bring together multiple conversations. In the next 40 minutes, each speaker will be given 10 minutes maximum, so that we do have more than half an hour for further discussions with the members of the audience. The speakers here are coming from, having their background in Latin America and Southeast Asia. So scholars who have been working in and on the regions, and they themselves are also very much embedded in those regions as well, despite working in institutions in Global North. So we have one additional thought to share is really going to be about how much we have to think of the knowledge production itself, especially think about each one's ontological presence. So one of the things that came to my mind while preparing for this event is really it's kind of how each one of us, academics, students, who may be coming from those regions of Latin America or Southeast Asia or other parts of Asia, working in Global North, having to face three different types of constraints, so to speak. So one constraint will be about where, as scholars based in Global North institutions, they have to face these constraints imposed upon by the institutions in the need of producing high quality research output in order to survive. Right? So there's a kind of imposed criteria such as what is required by the Research Excellence Framework, which is basically one major institution that is governing the way knowledge gets produced in the Global North, especially in the UK. So our colleagues will have to, as researchers based in Global North institutions, we have to somehow find a way to demonstrate their capability in order to survive and stay employed or remain as part of the academic community in the Global North. So that's one constraint. And at the same time, the second issue will be the exercise of academic activism as well. I think, as you can probably hear from what they share in our talks later today, they themselves are very much concerned about the life and the life of the people that they study, and they themselves are part of the people as well. And also, and by extension, the knowledge that they accumulate is also going to be used very much in order to help nurture the livability and equality of those people who they care about. So this inevitably involves academic activism to be exercised, and you have to think about a balance between producing high quality research output as per the need of the institutions they work for, while at the same time having to practice academic activism as well. And academic activism often is not very much well recognized when it comes to demonstrating their capability to their employers. The third and final issue I want to share is how much the critical scholars who are from the global north but who are working in the global from the global south, we have to negotiate with the distance they have to they are encountering. The distance, the physical, it can be a physical distance from where they are coming from and where they are working. And this distance also works in a very interesting way, because at the same time you have to think about how much these researchers who are from the global south working in global north are being accepted in the global south when they bring the knowledge back to where they come from, and at the same time how much they also are going to negotiate the distance in terms of actively engaging with current affairs. I myself am from South Korea, and therefore anything interesting things happening in Korea or China, Hong Kong, Singapore, where I study as part of my research, I can't go to take part in Hong Kong demonstrations simply because I'm here. And the very moment of all these interesting events taking place and onboarding will be basically beyond my reach, and I'll be also not being very much part of it. And later when I come back to the region, basically, you have to answer the question of where were you when these things were happening, right? And I think this thing will eventually become more and more deepening constraint when it comes to the researchers from the region working away from home, having to negotiate and struggle sometimes. And at the same time, we talk about the Western knowledge production, but because we are also sitting here in an institution based in Global North, one of the most prestigious institutions, both researchers from Global South and Global North will have to also negotiate with various other types of constraints, not just the Western hegemony of knowledge production, but constraints incurred by various other dimensions, such as race, ethnicity, gender, and seniority, all of which we actually have profound implications on the knowledge production and particular way of how this hegemony is extended. So this is why we have, you can probably guess, we have very intentionally put together panel speakers from two of them from having a stake in Latin America, and two others having a stake in Southeast Asia. So on the far right, we have Kin Alvarez, who is from DPU, Bartlett Development Planning Unit, who is currently doing her PhD. And we have May, who is from Czech Academy of Sciences, research fellow, who kindly came over from Czech Republic. Thank you very much for this. And our own LSE colleague, Audrey, in the Department of Methodology, joining us today and going to speak about Latin American context. We have Mara from Geography Department, who is LSE fellow, also joining us. All of them primarily, you can see, we have very intentionally put together female speakers rather than having all male white speakers in front of me. I think that's another way of us trying to somehow change the way we have entered the debate. So without further ado, we'll start with Tin. Each speaker will be given 10 minutes, and 10 minutes, no more than that. So. Please.
Thank you, Yun and Lee, for the invitation, and thank you everyone for coming. So I'm just gonna read my paper from my laptop, hope you don't mind. So my talk for today will reflect on the lack of engagement with the work of Southern urban scholars writing in and from the South. I begin by situating my work as Southern scholarship that aims to theorize urban transformation and dispossession on one hand, and climate displacement on the other, in vulnerable and at-risk Southern cities. Reflecting on names and places encountered in literature reviews, manuscript revisions, conferences, and conversations, I then inquire into the invisibility of other Souths in studies of urban global South. I use my experience as a reference point for illuminating absences and silences in a field that constantly challenges itself to diversify and provincialize both knowledge and knowledge creation. Finally, I explore three correctives that might help foster more thoughtful engagement with Souths of Southern scholarship. As a prelude and to contextualize the questions I ask, I'd like to talk a bit about my work. My PhD project aims to tell the story of spatial transformation and urban dispossession in Metro Manila, the national capital region of the Philippines, beyond processes of capital accumulation. Particularly, I ask how danger zone evictions spatially reconfigure the city region of Metro Manila and the peri-urban fringe. This type of eviction pertains to the eviction of informal settler households residing in waterway easements designated and territorialized via aesthetic codes as danger zones. Contemporary scholarship on Manila's urban development has focused largely on the role of capital accumulation and has in turn developed in the direction of critiques of neoliberalism and gentrification, as well as analyses of transnational economies and global reproduction networks. The transformation of Manila's landscape since the 1997 Asian financial crisis, often studied in the context of the real estate boom, whether as information technology and business process outsourcing zones, mixed-use enclaves, or what Cardenas calls cash crop condominiums, has been analyzed in terms of transnational capital flows, outsourcing, migration, and remittances. This orientation of explaining the city in terms of capital accumulation scripts the way evictions are understood. And it is such that urban dispossession in Manila has been explained as outcomes of gentrification, currently the dominant critical framework of critical evictions research across the global North and South. Without negating the veracity of this analytical framework, and indeed the empirics on the ground, the large-scale slum evictions along Manila's waterways in the aftermath of the Ondoy flood disaster points to a nascent mode of eviction that is systematic and programmatic rather than arbitrary, one that is premised on flood, disaster, and climate risk mitigation rather than capital accumulation. And while there are no numbers to quantify evictions by gentrification, recently, it has been possible to measure the scale and determine the extent of danger zone evictions due to the programmatic and systematic nature of dispossession. Indeed, between 2012 and 2017, 52,254 households, informal settler households, across Metro Manila have lost their homes under the Metro Manila Flood Management Project and the Informal Settler Families Housing Program. So evicting in the name of flood and disaster resilience has accomplished the historically impossible task of cleaning up Manila of transgressive and undesirable bodies and landscapes and valuable but colonized urban spaces such as waterways. So they were able to accomplish this more quickly than the febrile pace of real estate development beginning in the mid-2000s. The speed of the spate of slum evictions raises the question of whether gentrification theory remains an adequate framework for explaining urban dispossession in Metro Manila after 2009. Paying attention to unfolding events and realities on the ground, my project refrains from foregrounding neoliberalism and processes of capital accumulation as the underlying cause of the entire phenomenon of evictions, homelessness, and urban transformation. My work then is an attempt to theorize the new modes and drivers of dispossession in vulnerable Southern cities, and at the same time, a response to encouragements to theorize Southern urbanism from the South. Reflecting on the new dynamics I see unfolding in Manila, reading the writings about the city and browsing the literature in the broad topics of dispossession and urban transformation raise concerns about the circulation of ideas and their power to shape debates and the subjects we study. The scholarship on dispossession and homelessness, for example, is dominated by analyses of capital accumulation. However, the dynamics that play out in much of the world, including most of the global south, may not necessarily be as relevant or even ring true for other less visible places encumbered by the same phenomenon. I make this point in my article in the first issue of Radical Housing Journal, whose theme was on organizing around housing struggles in the post-2008 era, where 2008 is used as a metonym for the global financial crisis. Researching the changing dynamics of urban dispossession in Manila sensitized me to three related points. First, it is not only that knowledges about the well-represented geographies or the norths of critical urban scholarship circulate, or that little is known about the post-2008 housing situation in southern cities like Manila that dodged the most injurious impacts of the financial crisis, but also that the idea of the post-crisis assumes that the financial crisis impacts on housing were similarly, if not uniformly, felt across the global south. To the contrary, I argued that Manila's post-2008 crisis was not the global financial crisis, but the 2009 Ondoy flood disaster that spawned an eviction crisis produced by responses to floods and disasters and climate change. Now, I bring this up to illustrate the significance of accounting for the experiences of the Souths of the South by inquiring into the peripheries of critical Southern urban scholarship and by interrogating whether our concepts and assumptions resonate with lived realities. Manila is what many call under-researched, a term I am sympathetic to yet uncomfortable with. A charitable understanding denotes scholarly interest in a place, but in my mind, such interest carries a responsible engagement with places of scholarly extraction. The dearth of writings in Philippine cities relative to those in India and South Africa, for example, lead me to question whether some Souths are more interesting than others. But in thinking about this, I am prompted to ask a series of uncomfortable questions. Where are the scholars writing in and from the South? Without prejudice to excellence, why do some get cited more than others? Does my city's invisibility have to do with who is writing about it and where they are writing from? That is, does it matter who writes about an under-researched place? More specifically, will cities speak less interest in terms of more interest in terms of citations, for example, and invite more curiosity and gain more visibility if prominent scholars study them instead? Talking about power inequalities and knowledge production requires addressing the politics of citation practices. How do key works acquire status? How does an article gain citations? As authors whose works on a place, a concept, or illustration do we read? As professors whose writings on which places do we include in our syllabi? As reviewers and editors, who are we telling authors to cite? As scholars in various capacities, how do we cite and on what basis do we cite? Critical urban scholars, notably Robinson, Parnell, Watson, and Roy, have called for the diversification of the starting points for global urban theory, and urban scholars have taken this up to task. However, this problem is not just about the South being relegated as sources of data and as case studies, rather than as sites of theory formation, as Connell and Parnell and Robinson have argued. Because if in this context the South is more often than not used to elucidate, it might be worth thinking about our engagement with the work of Southern scholars, especially those writing from the South, particularly how we relegate them to supporting roles. So just very quickly, I would like to offer three corrective practices in support of the centering knowledge production and expanding the intellectual geographies of critical urban scholarship. These are favoring new critical voices, giving opportunities, and exploring another's backyard. If colonizing critical urban studies involves adopting new citation practices in researching, writing, and reviewing the urban, we are compelled to look at not just the cities we make visible, but also to the scholars whose works we engage. This will require a choice, sometimes between more visible theorists and new excellent voices, with strict word counts for the articles we write, whose names we include, and whose papers we say matter, is a political choice in whose experiences and ideas we circulate. Decolonizing knowledge production entails an attentiveness to the unwitting ways by which we treat Southern scholars as residual voices, names we append to more prominent ones, names we erase when we are asked to. If we make a political commitment to citing more women and indigenous scholars, then this commitment must likewise extend to Southern scholars outside the cities in the global north. And this requires a diligence that springs from attentiveness, derived from a curiosity to learn about who else is writing about a particular place, who else is making new arguments or making the same points but is less cited. This is a strategy not just for knowing cities, but also for theorizing them. Secondly, a privileging new voices likewise relates to whom we give opportunities and with whom we build connections. Here I bring in my experience to illustrate how new possibilities emerge. I'm fortunate to have published an article for the March Symposium issue of IJR, the International Journal of Urban Regional Research, alongside prominent urban scholars such as Gavin Shatkin, Liza Weinstein, Kian Go, and Andrew Rombach. But this was only possible after Gavin reached out to Philip Kelly, who's a professor of geography at York University, about people working on the topic of floods and urban inequality in Manila. Philip then recommended my co-author, Kenneth Cardenas, a PhD candidate in geography at York, who then got in touch with me as I was writing up my master's thesis on the same topic. Later, I would receive word from colleagues saying that they've included the article in their syllabi. And now I bring this as an example to think about how these unfolding of possibilities remind us of the voices we amplify when we give opportunities to and create linkages with Southern scholars. So inquire, reach out, put people in touch, and get out of the cliques we unwittingly form. Lastly, all this gestures to the importance of exploring local publications or national conferences to gain an awareness of what sorts of conversations are being had in the places we study. It pays to ask what local scholars talk about when they are writing about their own city, as it often reveals what lenses are relevant for understanding urban life and urban systems in a particular place. How many of us are members of professional societies of the cities we study? How many local scholars do we know? Many have written about the merits of collaboration. Maybe we should expand this to the academic communities we are studying. And for those of us who are studying a particular place, I wonder if it takes some commitment to place to create more meaningful engagement. Not just forging collaborations or bringing money to the South, as generously funded collaborative projects are wont to do. To learn about the place, to write things about it, and to say that these are the things happening there requires an attentiveness, not just to the processes that we discover in our fieldworks, but also to our engagement with the local field itself. So maybe these are demands that make more demanding our tasks as students, researchers, and professors, but I find that it is one that is necessary if we are serious about doing critical, decolonial, and radical scholarship. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think one of the lessons that hopefully we get out of this event will be thinking about global solidarity that will bring together researchers in different locations of all generations, and think about how you can bring them together to ensure that you give voices to people who are less represented. So, next, May.
So first of all, thank you to the Center for inviting me to be here. I'm really pleased. My name is May. I'm a research fellow at the Oriental Institute, which is part of the Czech Academy of Sciences. I'm going to talk about Asia's method and how one way we might be able to push the concept a little further. So, a recurring theme within Asian studies has been the concern that theoretical and conceptual framings, as well as methodological approaches to research, has been formed by their origins in the historical experiences, geographical conditions, and cultural contexts of Europe and North America. A notable contribution has been Kwan Sing Chen's Asia's Method towards deimperialization, which has had considerable impact not only in his field of cultural studies, but in the wider social sciences. Based on Takeuchi Yoshimi's formulation of Asia's method in 1960, which attempted to break away from dominant modes of thought that have been trapped in the colonial structure of academic institutions, Chen put forward the notion of centering Asia as an imaginary anchoring point that would enable a more grounded knowledge to emerge from the region. This involves utilizing Asian societies as reference points for one another, and entails a reorientation of knowledge away from the West as the origin and as its inevitable future. It also encompasses an interrogation into the idea of Asia itself, its derivativeness that has developed from modern European history, and the ways in which this pushes us to move beyond nationalist and Eurocentric frameworks. As a methodology, it involves a rigorous undoing of long-held assumptions in intellectual production on Asia, as well as allowing and opening up to common experiences and hitherto unacknowledged shared histories between and across Asian societies. This implies that a space be created in which multiple parallel and unspoken narratives, grounded in locally specific realities, while taking into account global dynamics, can exist. Therefore, an empirical focus in our research methodology will enable an understanding of relations and processes within Asia that are nuanced and specific, illuminating wider structures and patterns they form a part of, while at the same time eschewing generalizations on Asia and which overshadow differences and distinctions. As such, this is both a theoretical and methodological move that intends to bring the silences and the hidden into visibility in our research. Connections and disconnections across Asia are structured differently by power, history, and geopolitics, and the only way to make them observable is by turning our gaze on the empirical. I would like to interrogate and advocate for further methodological innovation by pushing beyond an inter-Asian referencing framework to include the explicit stance of being self-reflexive in our research. There has already been much that has been written and discussed in relation to this, in what has often been termed a decolonial turn. That is, the call to decolonize knowledge in the recognition that knowledge is not universal and independent of context, but is always deeply implicated in power and in the contingencies of time, location, and relations of production, as well as in structures, institutions, and praxis. I think it can be extremely productive to open up questions around how knowledge is produced and within what contexts. In particular, helpful in generating sharp analytical insights into workings of power within intellectual production. However, I think for a truly decolonial approach, we need to be much more specific than this. We need to turn the focus away from the academic institution, whose shortcomings and limitations have already been very well documented, away also from our academic selves, and instead focus on the parts of us that have not been formed by the academy, yet which we inevitably bring to our research, not partially, but primarily. It is the part of ourselves that we bring into the field to engage with other people when we conduct an ethnography, or interviews for an oral history, or talk to our informants, or allows us to gain access to events, information, and archives. In the field, we rarely use our academic selves because that part in itself is never fully capable of engaging and enrolling everyday people in our research projects. Our personal vernacular selves, therefore, are an important determinant factor constituting our research. It is also this self which hovers in the background as we interpret our data, interpret what we have seen and experienced. If the selves that we bring are such an intrinsic part of the research process, why is it not made more visible in our research findings? This issue becomes even more pertinent for those of us who are not only from the West. Social science as we know it is the product of the very world that it tries to explain, arising out of the political, historical, and intellectual milieu of Europe. The dominance of the Euro-American academic system means that we have all been formed by it, regardless of where in the world we have been trained, and therefore have mastered its habitus, the dispositions and tastes that are characteristic of the Western academy. However, our key influences and formation can also come from outside of it, particularly those of us not originating from the West. Therefore, what does it mean for our research to be both a scholar on Asia and from Asia? How do the connections and disconnections within and across Asia in our own personal biographies intersect with the Asian societies that we are studying? What difference does it make to research in terms of what it allows us to see or how we engage with others, when we ourselves are part of the linkages and gaps that occur across Asia. In reflecting on both the convergences and divergences that occur in our biographies, especially in hierarchies of race, gender, and class within Asia, we will consider how these can be linked to wider structures and processes. How much like the Asian societies we are studying and of whom we are a product, are themselves historically and politically constituted. Can this kind of methodological rigor point to new forms of knowledge on Asia, which, coming from a critical self-reflexivity, bring previously marginalized narratives into light? Adopting reflexivity not only as a form of description, but primarily as a mode of analysis. In line with a vision of theory as being based on detailed observations about dynamics internal to practices, we might need to interrogate our personal trajectories as Asian scholars and the ways in which it has informed our research practice, from the questions we ask to the limits and possibilities we experience in conducting research, to accounting for how our own background, training, and privileges informs our perception of the terrain in Asia. This also includes how it impacts on our research findings and significantly the ways in which we communicate them. In other words, to whom are we speaking? This position of critical self-reflexivity as mode of analysis, combined with an emphasis on empirical case studies, might be a distinct contribution to further discussion in both Asia as method and decolonizing academic research. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for inviting me. And as I said to Lee when he invited me, I'm actually not from the Global South, I'm European. It just happened that I wrote a book at the crossroads of international relations and sociology of science about the conditions of production and internationalization of social sciences in Brazil and India. So this is from this perspective that I will speak. So for this project, I interviewed around 80 scholars of three different generations in Brazil and India. I did participant observation in the main research centers in both countries. I worked on archives and I used secondary data about the history of science, history of foreign policy, and history of national public policy regarding science and higher education. And this fieldwork made me realize that now it has been around 40-30 years that this project of globalizing social sciences, internationalizing social sciences, decentering, decolonizing, etc., has been put on the agenda. And we have, in fact, enough perspective to empirically assess the effects of the initiatives taken so far, to account for them and to adapt them accordingly if we need, if we feel the need. So in this presentation, I will mention 3 points from the fieldwork in Brazil, and in particular in the discipline of international relations, scholars of international relations in Brazil, that directly address the topic of the panel. So the first one deals with the importance of South-South international networks and circuits of publication. In the discipline of international relations in Brazil, since the institutionalization of the discipline, there has been international networks from Brazilian scholars with South American scholars, because one of the main topics at the core of the institutionalization of the discipline was regional South American issues and issues of regionalization and Mercosur in South America. In this network, people were publishing internationally because they were mainly publishing in the Spanish-speaking South American journal. Different type of initiatives. So these initiatives were both informal and formalized through different type of institutionalization of a regional network. And this type of South-South network have been further encouraged by both federal and state agencies in Brazil. For example, one case I can mention is the creation of a publishing house by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, publishing books in Portuguese about international relations that are distributed freely in Portuguese-speaking country, for example, African Portuguese-speaking country. Another initiative is the creation of different think tanks and slash research centers about, for example, African and Asian, one about African and Asian studies in the 70s, and another more recently called the BRICS Policy Center, that also aim at creating South-South network. What we see is that the current incentives of decentering social science is in fact weakening instead of strengthening those networks, because in fact implicitly the incentives to globalize social science is implicitly synonymous with publishing in, is inviting those scholars to publish in English-speaking Anglo-American journal. So in fact, those scholars, they are incentivized to diversify the social science field globally, to not invest in those networks created locally, but to connect themselves with institutions like LSE. Otherwise, in fact, it does not seem as they are as international as if they connect themselves with the South American networks. So one way in which this is criticized by Brazilian scholars is that, and not all, some of the interviewees, is that the internationalization of social science in this current decolonized social science project is mainly framed into a south to north unilateral direction instead of south-south, of north to south. The second point deals with the common emphasis on theory as the privileged site to decolonize, diversify social sciences, when this choice is not neutral. Okay, so it is a choice to either engage in theoretical work or not engage in theoretical work, and this is not only a personal choice, as theory is differently valued in different subfields and different national traditions. In the case of Brazil and international relations in Brazil, the discipline has mainly been institutionalized in departments of history, as history of international relations, and heavily influenced by diplomatic history. So in fact, those scholars, they learn skills in archival work, etc., without engaging into international relations theories. So what this incentive of asking scholars from these traditions to contribute to international relations theory debate create is, as first, it put them in a comparative disadvantage, because this is not what they are trained into, but also it prevents other scholars globally from learning from the archival skills that are otherwise in a lot of places underrepresented. In the case of India, the debate, sorry, I'm here a bit crossing and going on the Asian side, but the debate in the relation to theory was a bit different, because from the previous generation, in fact, theory, not only the content of theory, but theory itself was perceived and described as scholars from previous generations as anti-patriotic and a colonizing project against the priorities of current priorities of the country that were better served by policy-oriented work. So you see how choosing theory and choosing to organize the debate around theory is not a neutral choice. And the third and last point relates to the comment made by some interviewees regarding to the experience of being framed as being from the global south, or asked to speak from the global south, and how this type of framing is in fact double-edged. On the one hand, these incentives actually give more voices and more spaces for scholars from the global south to express themselves, but sometimes this, on the other end, these incentives are also perceived as conditioning the way they can speak and what they can speak about. They confine these scholars into conforming with a certain type of discourse, a certain type of knowledge that is expected from the global south. So for example, some scholars have mentioned how they might be interested in European political theory, but it was not expected from them that they start talking and commenting about Deleuze and Foucault, because they were asked to join this type of events, speaking about their Brazilianness or development issues or their subalternity, even though they were not specialists about those questions. So, and this was not the way as they were framing themselves in their academic identity. So to conclude, I wanted to share with you these three points. I was surprised by the results of my fieldworks and by how the incentives to diversify social science in fact might hide invisible risk. The first one, centralizing circuit of publications in the north, in fact, performing the center periphery against South-South networks. Second point, homogenizing social science by legitimizing certain ways of doing social science, for example, theory versus non-theoretical work. And third, organizing conversation into pre-framed identity that might not necessarily reflect the way scholars experience themselves. Thank you.
Well, those three speakers give us a lot to think about, actually. So I look forward to the Q&As and debate. But before that, Mara?
Yeah, should I stand? I do have a high points more for guiding me than okay, so I'm gonna speak here so I can actually operate this thing. So what I'm gonna try to do today to contribute to this debate is talk about a particular concept which is relevant for my own research, which is informality, which is allegedly a concept that was created by the Global North to decodify what people were seeing happening in the Global South. And I'll try to sort of discuss a few contributions from Latin American scholars to this debate from the 1970s that kind of speak to current debates and this attempt to move beyond this concept, move beyond this binary way of thinking. So just to contextualize here, these kinds of debates that are going on around the issue of informality, discussions, for instance, about how you're moving beyond the kind of idea of the proper job, how wage employment is becoming less and less important around the world, but also in urbanism, more specifically, the need to transcend informal urbanism and to kind of regard formality itself as an exception and to recognize how formality is a negative concept that doesn't really describe what's being seen, but rather just attribute a negative kind of connotation to those activities. So this is sort of the context in which I'm working on. And in this special issue recently published in the Urban Studies, there was a paper by Abduk Simon that was entitled From the Informal to the Popular, in which he talks about how in the Global South, many scholars are now kind of shifting from discussing informal economies to popular economies. I have to give it to Simone for actually knowing about this, but what I would like to say is that this is not happening now. This is a conversation that is going on since at least the 1970s in Latin America. So alliterations from Latin America have dealt with issues which are now kind of back in the agenda. So one of them is the discussion about popular economies or popular solidarity economies by this guy there, José Luis Corrado, who is an Argentinian economist. In Brazil as well, there's discussions about the intersections between these two kind of circuits of the economy were also kind of dealt with by this other guy called Milton Santos, which is very relevant for geography in Brazil as well. And finally, this last guy here, Francisco de Oliveira, who is an urban sociologist from a Marxist tradition, which wrote in the 1970s this book called The Critique to the Dualist Reason, a dualistic way of thinking. And this is the theory that I would like to kind of delve in a little bit more. And ultimately, what I want to discuss here is how can we actually talk about theory from the South. What does it mean to be a Latin American scholar? Is that something which is possible to actually think about? How will those kinds of ways of thinking actually produce, and who is influencing, which debates were influencing their ways of thinking as well? Right? So more specifically about the work of Francisco de Oliveira, who's very, very prominent in Brazil and has influenced many people after him, as I'm going to say in a bit. he was actually responding to another kind of way of thinking that is also connected to Latin America. So the underdevelopment theory, which was created around the 60s and 70s as well by the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, which was mostly interrogating issues of development in Latin America at the time. In this tradition, there was a critique already to the Verstovian model of development, in which you would see kind of societies progressing from rural until reaching kind of what was Fordism then in the global north. And here in Latin America, people were already kind of criticizing that, calling attention to the fact that the underdevelopment was not a ladder in that staircase. It was actually a particular kind of historical and social historical condition that required something else. And state-led industrialization was then advocated as a route to reach development by this tradition. However, for Oliveira, he was criticizing that, because in this tradition, informality or traditional or the traditional sector was seen as something that would be eventually kind of eradicated with modernization. So it was kind of a residual from traditional ways of operating the economy that would eventually kind of disappear if the sort of state industrialization model would be successful. For him, however, he interpreted this dualistic existence of the informal and the formal as actually the precondition for capitalist development in the periphery. So how does that work? For instance, he saw things such as the favelas that were appearing in various places in Latin America, and this sort of practice of outer construction as a feature of peripheral urbanization. So by providing themselves with housing, people moving to urban areas were actually helping to lower the cost of capitalism reproduction, right? They were providing themselves with services that they would have to be provided by either by the state or by the firms employing them. So those kinds of anomalies were actually what made capitalist development possible in the periphery, rather than something that was going to disappear with capitalist development, is actually a product of capitalist development. So people that were living in the favelas, they're working informal jobs, they were actually not excluded from capitalist development. They were excluded from the benefits of urbanization, but actually very much important for the process itself. The importance here of Francisco de Oliveira, not only to create this theory, but he also was the mentor of a series of Brazilian scholars, some of them you might have heard of, such as Emília Maricato, Raquel Ronick, and Nabil Bonduc, which not only became prominent scholars in Brazil, but later on influenced how urban policy in Brazil was shaped. So they, all the three of them, were somehow involved in, for instance, the creation of the city statute in Brazil. So you see how a theory here is not only kind of influencing how subsequent theory is going to happen, but also how policymaking is kind of developing in Brazil. And however, what I would like to kind of like try to tease you with is that Chico de Oliveira was actually very much influenced by Manuel Castells. So in the 1970s, when Brazil was already kind of suffering with a dictatorship that got harder after 1968, until 1973, Chile was kind of a safe space for Latin American academics. And in the 1970s, Manuel Castells was visiting the University of Chile, and a lot of Brazilian scholars actually kind of got in touch with his theory. And a lot of what Chico de Oliveira was writing about is influenced by the marginality theory that Castells was then developing. It was somehow a critique, but also kind of a development of this theory. And if you want to go even back further, Manuel Castells is being influenced here by Althusser, right? And his vision of capitalism, his vision of how the capitalist accumulation process happened. So just to like kind of think about here what's then the basic limitation of that theory that I was discussing. It basically can be criticized for the same reasons that Castells was then being criticized, right? The urban for Francisco de Oliveira is also kind of a reflection of the political economy. So if the urban lacks here some sort of dynamics of itself, right? However, it also has influenced a lot of studies that were empirically grounded, and it started to dismantle those ideas that formal and informal sectors were actually separated, but showing how those sort of informal settlements had markets, had social roots, were embedded in some sort of types of social practices, although not the formal rationalized ones, right? So just in terms of to conclude, what I would like to kind of end with is this interrogation about the possibility of having knowledge produced in the South or from the South in a context in which knowledge production doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? So all academics in the Global South, even those who are in Global South institutions, they are also kind of drinking from the same sources that we are all drinking from. So how does that influence what can we call sort of Global South knowledge, right? And also for regional inequalities here, because I'm not from São Paulo and all of those people are from São Paulo, and they dominate the way that scholarship is produced in Brazil. So how then to take this thing to another level? What kinds of cities or spaces within the Global South are shaping Global South knowledge? And yes, just to say that giving voice to Southern voices is important, but not enough if we really want to decolonize how social sciences are kind of produced. And,
thank you very much. We did hear excellent speeches, four excellent talks, a lot for us to think about. But we also want to open up to the floor so that we can kind of engage in further debate. You may speak, ask questions to our speakers, or also you can just make a statement as well, unlike all those other academic units. And then we eventually, we are asked not to make statements, but I think here, as long as you make it brief and concise, you're also welcome to make a statement. But it'll be also nice to engage with what has been discussed so far by the speakers as well when you make the statement. So let us kind of collect perhaps two or three questions, a statement or thoughts, and I think you want to share with the audience. With no random care over there, what are? Can you introduce yourself to the members of the audience?
Hi, I'm Al. I am a senior candidate here in organization development. I think my question was about, I think some things that were brought up throughout the panel about this idea of a corrective. So firstly, like, what is the problem being fixed if there's a corrective, right? And secondly, so I heard this recommendation of giving more voices, but at the same time, you know, if you give voices to a Southern, in a Southern frame, it kind of like delegitimizes that person. So. And I think the first speaker talked about this idea of giving more voices to the South and using Robinson, but for me, I have a different interpretation of Robinson because she talks about theory traveling in any direction in that book over there. So I'm wondering, like, what do you mean by giving more voice to the South? Is it about giving more Southern voices or, like, taking away that frame, you know, because we shouldn't be looked as Southern people because it delegitimizes, like, what we're trying to say in the first place as a frame. So, yeah.
Okay. Top questions. Maybe one or two more. Yes, I hope. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Niranjana. I just started with a postdoc at LSE Geography as well. And I was noting down quite a few questions as the first three speakers were speaking. And then when Mara concluded with her observation about how even scholars in the Global South are often speaking more to scholars within the academic circles rather than with a local context and so on. So they're not in any, like the Sao Paulo centricness of Brazil. I mean, I research on India and I feel like much of India is being spoken for by Delhi, not by the rest of the country. And now there is more of like scholars coming from other places, And when someone was speaking about under-researched places, I've had the same questions. And now the scholars are coming from other places. What are they talking about and who are they speaking to? So my broader question then is, we're talking about decolonizing South-South interactions and so on, but is that possible at all within an academic tradition? Because the academic tradition is by itself responding to a canon, and what canon are we responding to? And as Hume mentioned at the beginning, I face the same problem when I go back to the field. There's a canon already forming there outside academic voices, outside researchers. So who am I speaking to? Am I speaking to the people here, or am I speaking to my field, or to my participants, as it were? And they have their own voice now. They don't need to rely on me to interpret them to the outside world or to academia and so on. So broader question again is, should we be thinking more about the South-South and decolonizing academia and so on? Or would decolonizing academia actually mean that academia becomes less inward-looking and more outward-looking, that it starts speaking to canons other than the academic canon?
One last one over here.
Yeah, I'm Santiago, a postgraduate in urbanization and development. And I have a question I would like to ask Dr. May. You just mentioned the East Asia framework. But my question is, does the East Asia framework really exist? If everyone wants to, you know, establish a framework of Asia, maybe they have just a case study. A case study is not enough for a framework. That will be into another paradigm confusion, that everyone will follow their own source and own methods for research for their research findings. And everyone just follow their personal thoughts, that actually there is not a really paradigm or framework of the East Asia, but we have to try to analyze the things in practical and in their particular situation. But it's a really a contradiction that we want to establish a framework, and we know it's important to establish a framework of East Asia studies, but we can't, and we are not able, and it's not scientific or reasonable to establish this framework in the research findings and in the research now. So I don't know what's your opinion, and maybe we can't realize to establish a East Asian framework, or we have to try to fight for it.
Okay, perhaps we start with this, unless you are asking any related question in a very short manner.
Yes, so I'm Julie, I'm a history scholar, and I'm really interested about that concept that Dr. May have come up with. Why are some cells, for example, are more interesting than other cells? And I think that's a really interesting question, because like the case in Brazil, you can see there's like a intellectual economic history thread going on, but in a case like, let's say, Philippines, they don't have like a structured and organized intellectual community, but that's the case with Brazil. So yeah, I think that's definitely a question to reflect on.
Okay, I think we have more than enough. And would you like to respond to any of these questions? Maybe starting with Tim.
You asked about what if there's a if I'm proposing three correctives, then what's the problem? I think what is being fixed by these correctives is exactly the topic of this panel, which is the power inequities and knowledge production. It's the imbalance as it pertains to who gets to shape debates, who gets to become examples, who are cited as authorities, and who eventually gets to shape the field. So I offer those three correctives as a potential. It's something for us to think about as we write our own work, as we engage with other people's work. And I agree with your reading of Jennifer Jennifer Robinson. So I would like to clarify that I actually tried to scan my paper, and I believe that I did not actually mention giving voices. I spoke of voices in terms of amplifying them, in terms of engaging these voices, which I believe is different from actually giving voice. And that point you made about theory traveling back and forth, theory influencing one place and then traveling back to its source of origin, is exactly what I'm trying to get at. It's what I tried to get at when I made this this presentation, because it's giving for theory to travel back and forth. I think what's important to consider is whose voices we actually listen to, whose voices we actually engage, and what sorts of opportunities do we give scholars from more marginal places. So that's, I think we need to be more generous, and we need to be more diligent in producing not just the knowledge and producing knowledges, but also in engaging places and in engaging sites and even people from whom we extract these knowledges.
Anyone else from the panel?
Just to ask you, thank you for your question. Just to clarify, what do you mean?
I just found out we do have a mic.
Oh,
maybe.
Do I need it?
Well, just in case.
Okay.
It's a new center building. It's meant to be coming with the latest technology. Let's make use of it.
You mentioned an East Asian framework. I don't know if I talked about that. Can you clarify what you mean by? Hello. Can you clarify what you mean by an East Asian framework in particular?
At the beginning of your speech, that you said the power, history, and geopolitics in Asia is really important.
Mm-hmm.
That we need to discuss the questions or do the researches. Under an East Asian framework.
Oh, I think I said perhaps I said inter-Asian. No, I think I said inter-Asian referencing, So I guess Asia's method would be, for example, my research is on Cambodia, and although it has been colonized by the French and has had intervention from the West, the US in particular, looking at, my project looks at factories and industrialization processes in the country. And when I started looking at who was actually there, most of the factories are owned by East Asian countries. And also a lot of workers were also moving out of Cambodia to other Asian countries. So I think it's this broadening kind of our lens to see the ways in which kind of Asian society, there are already connections and there have always been connections across Asian societies, and kind of just moving the focus away from the kind of the obvious players like the West, like Europe. And looking at the connections and the interconnections between and across Asian societies. I think that was more what I was trying to communicate, rather than an East Asian or Southeast Asian framework. And I think a inter-Asian referencing can also help to look at the inequalities and the hierarchies within Asian countries as well, rather than Asia just being one kind of entity. So that was kind of more what I was looking at.
Can you maybe give other speakers
I would like to follow on this and on the comment about Delhi-centrism.
Sorry, I think the mic doesn't seem to be working.
So, can I speak without the mic?
Yeah, without the mic.
So yeah, for the fieldwork in Delhi, it was the fieldwork in India. It was clear, for example, for the discipline of international relations that it is extremely Delhi-centered. Indeed, and in the trajectory of scholars not coming from Delhi, they were narrating how it was harder to get into Delhi and to be recognized in Delhi coming from the regions than once they are in Delhi, go and have an international careers. And also how, for example, they were actively looking for sabbaticals and funding to go to the US or to go to the UK to escape the pressure and the censorship with Delhi and felt by Delhi colleagues, and also how people who had, for example, a background in like their family were also already scholars from Delhi. In fact, they were so Delhi-centered that sometimes they were speaking about how going outside Delhi was as if you were going to another country in their discourse, if you do discourse analysis. So I could really relate with the example of São Paulo, and this also, the framing of the event was like decolonizing IR, etc. But I think I agree with you that what does it mean to invite voices from the global south, and this kind of subtlety that it is a bigger issue about how do we tackle social connective hierarchies and discrimination in academia that are more complex than just north, south, west, non-west, even though that this is a big issue. But simplifying that may in fact increase other type of inequalities, and for example, who are the scholars who are always invited to this kind of decolonized LSE event, etc. There are like a few scholars from GNU, basically from the biggest university in India. So we need a much more holistic framework that is contextualized and case by case. And or for example, in the case of UK, we are all from different countries from all over the world, and nonetheless there are very few people for low socioeconomic background from the UK and from certain region in the UK. This is an elite international institution that discriminates people from this country.
Well, following up on that, like that's true for any kind of academic institution everywhere in the world. So I mean, that's the kind of your question for me translated into: is it possible to decolonize a deeply colonial institution such as the university? Because those hierarchies and those kinds of situations in which universities are actually populated by the elites of the places where they are, especially the good ones that get to say something, right? It's not only LSE, it's like the University of São Paulo, for instance. It's like it's definitely not catering for the lower classes in Brazil. And how do their experience get read and get interpreted by those people who are from the same country but are not actually living that kind of everyday life, right? And I think that's a question for, even like when you think about sort of this, as a scholars when we do field work, right? And the discussion about global north people doing research about global mm-hmm. south and things, but us as well from the global south who do this research in the global mm-hmm. south, we are also kind of somehow disconnected most of the times from the realities we are trying to interpret. So my interlocutors in the field were not kind of like the kind of people that I would meet on my everyday life as well, most of the cases, right? And so how does production of knowledge also happens within those same contexts and those social structures that we can't really escape. So I think, yeah, it's a long conversation.
Somehow, at least the knowledge production in general. yes, so more questions perhaps. One over here.
Could
you also introduce yourself?
My name is Montita. I'm a student in medical anthropology at SOAS. And I had a question about, someone mentioned the canon and like how kind of cultivating oneself within the academy requires attention to a specific canon, and the decolonization project is necessary because that canon often is white, male, European, etc. there are certainly histories of knowledge production that are not like based in the European Enlightenment. And in terms of thinking about the canon, not just as the current syllabi that students have to read, but also the theories upon which we develop, like how could we have thought of a theory from the South that wasn't based on Althusser and then led to XYZ and then is now represented as the South, right? But like a different lineage and a different genealogy, or is it too late to kind of try to develop those alternative lineages? And then is it, if it is too late, then what do we do?
Sorry, can I just clarify that slightly? I didn't mean the canon as in only because it was quite near European, but also because academic canon, like Mara pointed out by itself, is any disrespect to
So I guess all axes of power, including like not just race and geography, but also socioeconomic status and family background.
Perhaps one or two more from the floor. Yes.
Hello, I'm Hyunji Cho from the CRO. I recently completed my PhD about South Korea. And this is quite a practical question and can be something that's personal experience about that. I would like to point out some limitation that I feel when I write the traditional academic journal, like 8,000 words or piece of the work, and then I happen to be represent my country in a kind of global north academic field, and I found traditional form of the academic journal is really limited. They have a really strong limitation to explain all the complexity in the country and what my positionality in doing some field work and then how to analyze those things to explain in those limited words. So I would like to ask, have you ever feel those kinds of difficulties to explain your context in limited words, and how do you, have you ever tackle successfully those things, like as you mentioned, including something more voice in bibliography or something like that. I'm just curious about those approach.
Okay, another one at the back. Yeah, you, yes.
Yeah, my name is Michelle. I was in the graduate of MRC studying international relations. And I just want to ask a question to add to the previous conversation, actually, what Tamara was saying, and you said this is a long conversation, and I'm wondering if it was okay to listen to just a bit of it more, specifically to the question about what would you recommend to, a thing that might be useful to people in this room, which is what would you recommend to an academic from the South doing their work in a northern institution, and how are we supposed to go on with our work, trying to give voice, supposedly, or trying to illuminate something from where we are from without reproducing the power hierarchy that you're talking about. Because essentially, when we go back to wherever we go, we are carrying the level of our institution, and we impair our level of institution of LSC. Some people might perceive it as an elite institution, and hence give us the power to swap more, and isn't that in itself reproduces the power that we are trying to put inside our countries.
Okay, so we have three more questions. If you do have your own thoughts to respond to these questions, by all means raise your hand and just join the debate, all right? We don't have to always listen from the speakers.
Can I
but
just
we do want to listen from you. Yeah.
Just respond to that, and also the other things like decolonizing the canon, writing differently for academic journal articles, how not to reproduce power. I feel like talking about all of these is kind of not pointless, but we have to address like careers in academia and how, like, especially as early career researchers, we are like struggling to survive. And this means that it will make us easier to fall into line in terms of how we publish, who we cite, what kind of research we do. And so it's funny, like, I find it interesting that institutions are talking about decolonize this, decolonize that, but they're not talking about relations of production within academia and how the precarity and the whole kind of academic system for young researchers is not conducive doing things differently. We kind of have to reproduce, you know, power, the relations of power, and do business as usual, because otherwise we won't survive in this institution, in the system. And it's already a very privileged place. I mean, you also have to have so much, you have to have some kind of access to socioeconomic support in order to be able to stay in academia over the, you know, the many years. So I feel like we need to also talk about careers in academia and how, structural issues.
Following up on that, yeah, also sure. For people in academia, we can criticize the fact that the syllabus are like very Eurocentric, but when you are already established and also like gender biased, and you've been trained in a literature that is biased, and you got a job into a career, and that now you're asked to be productive, it is very costly to say I will take 1 year to only read things that I don't know from other countries instead of publishing for my career advancement. And a lot of people, it's not that they are not sensitive and interested in the project, is that in fact they are afraid for, because of neoliberal capitalist incentives, and the system, the economic system is not incentivizing and providing time to reread all the new body of literature so they can put that on the syllabus.
Yeah, that also reminds you that knowledge production also happens within the circuit of capital accumulation, right? And we are sort of involved in that somehow as well. And I don't know how to respond to your question, basically. I think that it has to do a lot with what they were saying before in terms of like how this power structures, they're kind of like, we are embedded in them in such a way that sometimes it's easier to try to, you know, survive and to try to just go on with your career than to try to dismantle the structures that exist, right? But I think careers is the first thing that we need to start thinking about. And I mean, also education in terms of access, right? This is an expensive place, right? And sort of we are in a very elite place, which not everyone can have access to. And this is kind of like, this has been sort of shaping as way how institutions work, right? Not only our careers, but also how students are like, the commodification of education more specifically. I think it's an issue that affects us all and creates the sorts of pressures that we all, early careers specifically, suffer daily.
Kim?
Yeah. Building up on what's already been said, I think the power structures are also very much entrenched and upheld in institutions of the global south themselves, like in the University of the Philippines, for instance, faculty members get a monetary reward for publishing in international journals, and it depends on the level of prestige of the journal. So academics sometimes have to confront this dilemma of where to publish their work. Are they doing it, are they gonna publish their work in a more prestigious, top ranking, ISI indexed journal, or are they going to publish their research in local local university published journals? But then if you also, it's also interesting because in the field of urban studies, Philippine urban studies per se, the sorts of articles that make it in local publications are not exactly the These are not exactly the types of conversations that appeal to international publishers. So sometimes when I speak with colleagues, it's also, they tell me that it's also a matter of knowing where to publish the articles that are supposed to get you tenure, the articles that you just have to produce to make it through the year. So yeah, that's also one thing to think about when we talk about how these power structures are upheld in Global South institutions. Also because as I follow very closely the works produced on Philippine cities, particularly in Metro Manila, and I've noticed that those that receive the citation their work deserves are actually scholars who have published in highly visible top ranking journals that are difficult to access even in the Philippines, like IJER, for instance, because it's under Wiley. It's such a shame, but it's not the University of the Philippines, which is the premier university in the country, doesn't even have access to that. So yeah, but then there's also some, when you scan the literature in Philippine urban studies, you'll also encounter material of the same caliber that's published in local journals. And when I encounter these works, I sometimes wonder whether it's possible for them to gain the attention, to gain the same traction that, you know, publications published in more prestigious journals would obtain.
It is listened to very inspiring and also thought-provoking talks, and also thanks so much to the audience, who may raise very important questions as well. While I listened to the talks, one thing that came to my mind is, when was the first time I wrote anything in Korean, my own language, mother tongue, after having my PhD many years ago? And I can only think of the first piece I wrote in Korean was like maybe 8 years after I had my PhD. The first 8 years were involving me struggling in my own way to establish myself in a place like LSE, writing continuously books and articles in English for those to be helping me to get established. But I think it was only in 2016 or 15 I wrote my first kind of meaningful piece in Korean, thinking that I can't continue to write only in English. When it comes to knowledge dissemination, I have to write in the language that which is used by the people who I study. And although I am still to do this in Chinese, but that's a different category language issue, perhaps. But I think this is also one of the things I guess you can do.
Were you consciously aware that it was because you had reached a certain stage in your career that you had?
Well, I think it did help. It did make some. I think it did influence. Yes, I have to say because allocating my limited time, and spreading across teaching, research, and other things, and admin and duties, and so on, I couldn't find the time, to do something extra. In addition to what I have to demonstrate, so that kind of, and then I continue to somehow try to find the occasion to write in non-English language if I can. So I have a paper in Japanese, although not translated, not written by myself, but translated by someone else. But that's also one thing I'm doing in my own way. But also that kind of raises questions about the negotiating with all these academic games we have to do within very highly commodified and capitalized institution that is university, which actually is not only the case within the UK, but everywhere else, as our speakers were pointing out. Before I finish, I'm going to ask each speaker to make one sentence statement about what they are going to do after tomorrow and after today in terms of helping decolonize LSE or the academia. Anything
you should
that you
have
can think of,
tell us beforehand.
That you want to put into practice, however small it's going to be. So I'm going to thank everyone, but I'm also going to make an announcement, if I may. So this is one of the decolonizing LSE events After this event, there's another one starting at 6 o'clock today, which is film screening. They can, the title of the film, I think, is The Racism with a subtitle of History. I think this is going to be in Farrah and Steve room, which is on the like 1.5 floor of old building, between first and second floor of the old building. So it's nice very nice committee room, but also very nice for film screening as well. There's another event of Decolonizing LSE tomorrow at 6 o'clock in Grant Wallace room, which is on the fifth floor of the old building, with the title of Towards a Decolonial Feminist Praxis, Decolonizing Gender Studies Curricula. Right, so those two immediate events are going to be of interest to many of you. And I may also have to say, if you go to LSE, the SEAC website, there are events that are going to be hosted by Southeast Asia Center. The next one is going to be a seminar series on, I think, on the 18th of October, which looks at the land grabbing in Southeast Asia, I think in Cambodia. So there's one nice one coming up. So if you are into land grabbing as well as Southeast Asia or any one of those two, please do come and join us. LSEO Southeast Asia Center also has the, I'm giving you time to think about this. LSE Southeast Asia Center also has announced this very nice scheme for stipendiary visiting researcher scheme in order to bring researchers who are working on and in Southeast Asia to spend up to 3 months maximum to spend their time at LSE with all the living cost and travel expenses covered by the center. So if you do know any any researcher who are falling into this category, who may benefit from the scheme so that they can spend their time away from their home institution, which may come with various constraints, you know, so that they don't really have time to flourish as researcher. LSE Southeast Asia Center is giving time and space and for them to engage in a critical way with other researchers and with and also doing self-reflection. So please do spread the word if you know any such colleagues, you know, who may be able to benefit your former teachers or colleagues, you know, who you are aware of. Let them hear about the scheme. So I've given you enough time by now. So let's start with Mara.
Thank you. But what am I going to do?
Make it short, one sentence.
I'll try to get some British Academy money or colonial money to organize a workshop on other economies and invite my Brazilian friends.
I'm going to try to focus more in my research and my teaching on cases that show agency and relationality outside of the Northern Core, like South-South and South-North agency.
I'm trying to make more connections with like-minded people who are thinking about these issues, and also having fun, because this is kind of heavy stuff.
Okay.
It's something that I've already started doing. I'm building a Manila reading list on urban and disaster studies, and I'm going to try to make it public once I'm done with it.
Thank you very much. So thank you very much, everyone. And many thanks to the speakers.